You've entered Book Storm with Kristen Civiletto and me, Chris Storm. This is a podcast devoted to best-selling books that matter, books that make a difference. We're diving down deep with beloved authors about their stories. We're exposing hot-button topics and heartfelt themes, the issues that affect each of us in our own lives, as siblings, parents, partners, friends, as human beings. We're braving new ideas, fresh thoughts, hard lessons, and important truths. Those kinds of things that stay with us long after we turn the last page and close the book. Well, welcome back to Bookstorm Podcast, listeners literally all over the world. We're super grateful for all of you. We know why you're here with us today, because we're bringing you not only best-selling fiction, but fiction that Kristen and I love, books that we have read and we have vetted and we long to share with you. We have one such book and a fabulous author with us here today. We're welcoming Patty Callahan Henry and her book, The Secret Book of Flora Lee, which is now out in paperback. So grab yours right away. And Patty, welcome to Bookstorm.
Oh, I'm so pleased to be here. I've been looking forward to this. We kept trying to schedule, and I was like, it's today. We finally get to talk today. So I'm glad to be here.
We are longtime fans of Patty's and the Friends of Fiction podcast website live show, and we're very much looking forward to you being here. Before we get started, I like to give our listeners a little bit of your bio, because you have so many fans, and maybe there's a little golden nugget that they don't know about you. So listeners, Patty is a New York Times, Globe and Mail bestseller, USA Today bestseller. She's the author of 17 novels, including the book we're here to talk to her about today. She's also the recipient of a lot of very highly regarded awards: the Christie Award for Book of the Year, the Harper Lee Distinguished Writer Award of the Year, the Alabama Library Association Book of the Year. Wow. As I just mentioned, she's the co-host and co-creator of a popular weekly online live web show and podcast. And if you haven't seen it, you can find it everywhere, including on Facebook Live, which is where I watch it. It's called Friends and Fiction. It's a wonderful show with some very fabulous co-authors. And I see you have another podcast where you're showing original content for a couple of your novels, Surviving Savannah and Becoming Mrs. Lewis.
Yeah. So when I finished both of those novels, I had done so much research that I thought that I couldn't put in the novels. So I published all the interviews that I did. So they're kind of a behind the scenes look at those two novels.
Wow. This is so admirable. And we're just learning and watching everything you do. In addition to this, she's a full-time author, mother of three, grandmother of two, lives in Alabama. We're thrilled she's with us for a little bit today. Can't wait to dive down deep into The Secret Book of Flora Lee.
Oh, I'm thrilled. Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Patty, before we get started, I wanted to give our listeners a little bit of the background of your story, and I won't give away any spoilers, I promise. And at the end, of course, if you want to add anything, by all means, we would love that. Now, in your story, we are transported to London of 1939. England and France have just declared war on Nazi Germany, and England has instituted a program where they're trying to evacuate people from these high target areas, some of the bigger cities. Now, in their story, 14-year-old Hazel and 5-year-old Flora, her sister, are evacuated from their London home to a rural village. Now, they were fortunate. They were able to stay with a very kind family. We meet Bridie. Is that how you pronounce it, Bridie?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. We meet Bridie Aberdeen and her teenage son, Henry. And they live in a very charming stone cottage right along the River Thames. Hazel fills their days with walks and games to distract her younger sister, including a fairy tale that she creates for them both to enjoy and to escape into. It has a river, it's a magical land, and it's something that the two of them only share. Now, one day, a tragedy strikes while they are living with the Aberdeens, and young Flora disappears. She was playing along the river edge, and she vanishes. Now, let's fast forward 20 years in your story. Hazel is now in London. She's ready to take on a dream job with Sotheby's. She works with a rare bookstore seller right now. And on her last day, she unpacks a package, and there is this beautifully illustrated book. And lo and behold, it is the story that she used to talk to her sister about. Now, this opens up so many wounds for her. She has carried guilt throughout her life about the loss of her sister. But now we've got these possibilities. Maybe she could learn about what happened to her sister, any other details. But this story really turns on this beautiful sisterhood relationship about, you know, faithfulness and loyalty and incredible deep dives into our emotions and what we carry in our lives and who we are. Did you want to add anything to that summary?
I want to add that I would like for you to go on book tour with me and give that summary. I was nodding and smiling the whole time because I'm like, she's doing a better job than I do when I describe it.
Thank you.
I always get off on all these tangents. You kind of boiled it down to its essence. You know, one of the favorite things we always ask when we're on Friends in Fiction too is, that's what the story is about, but what's it really about? And you even nailed that, right? About hope and loyalty and sisterhood. And I also think in an immense way, the only thing I would add is that it's really about the power of story in our lives and how it comes to us at the right time.
Well, that is perfect timing because my first question is exactly that.
Oh, great.
I loved the importance of story in this novel. Yeah. Edwin said, stories and books tend to find their rightful owners. Hazel said her story was a refuge for us while the world was burning around us. Mm. Wrighty said, don't let others take away good stories just so they can feel better about themselves. Stories are soul-making. Wow. Oof. For the writer and also the reader, yes, we believe all of these things. Can you expand as the writer of this beautiful, touching story? Why are stories so important to us since the beginning of time to this day? And why can't we live without them?
Wow, I love that you pulled out all four of those quotes from different sources in the book. I'm so touched. You know, we are made for story. We are quite literally, as human beings, wired for story. And since the beginning of time, before we were even had written language, we told stories on cave walls. It is how we make meaning of the meaningless. It's how we make sense of the senseless. I talk about how there are, in the original languages, Greek and Latin, there are two words for word, logos meaning logic, and mythos meaning myth, and how we need both, like, but nobody changed anybody's heart with logic, right? So we need logos, we need logic, but we also have mythos and myth, and it's how we change hearts and minds. It's where mystery and paradox and making sense of things comes in when you have a story. And so I feel like the power of story, especially for me in my life, has been the thing that has sustained me and kept me sane. It's the place where I have found meaning when there often isn't. And a number of my books have been not a reflex or a response, but a search for meaning. For example, Once Upon a Wardrobe, I wrote during COVID, like, how do we make sense of these things that our senses, how do we take these things in our life that are hard and through the alchemy of story, make them into something else? So I believe that when we're looking for meaning, there's poetry, there's story, there's music, but story is one of the most important, and it is how we communicate with each other on a soul level. So
that is so beautifully said. And this is why we love books so much. I want to give one more quote. Peggy quoted Oscar Wilde. She said, telling beautiful, untrue things was the aim of art. But then she said, beautiful, untrue things carry truth. Do you think stories are our way of sharing truth when no one will listen to us otherwise?
100%. I mean, always say that fiction isn't true, but it holds the truth, right? So these stories we tell are the best of them, not all of them, but these stories that touch us, these stories that we walk away, we put down a book and go, wow, right? They didn't tell you the truth, right? Like Hazel and Flora Lee never lived, except in my imagination and hopefully now in yours, but they told the truth. They told the truth about hope, about the power of story, about love, about trauma, about how we carry things in our body. So this story told a lot of truth, but the story wasn't true. And I think that is one of the greatest paradoxes and mysteries of storytelling. And there's a science too. I mean, there's science now that proves, like I said, that we are wired for it, that it is how we communicate. And there are books that can prove through time how it rewires our brains, how it changes the way we see the world, and how essential and elemental it is in the human condition. It is how we make sense of being, well, human, you know? So,
thank you. Every reader listening can definitely agree with that.
Betty, I want to ask you a little bit about the historical backdrop. We talked about this Operation Pied Piper, and Hazel calls it a nursery rhyme name for a horror of an idea.
Yes.
In 1939, Britain and France had just declared war on Nazi Germany, and I did not realize the scale of this operation. 1.5 million people, but 800,000 of whom were children.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that? Because these families, what they must have gone through is almost unimaginable. And I see traces of that echoing today.
Oh, I know. When I see some of these images on TV, I want to pull up the images of Operation Pied Piper and show it to people and say, why do we keep repeating these things? Why do we keep repeating them? So Operation Pied Piper was years in the making. But then the edict came down in September of 1939. So there were posters all over every big city, whether it was London or Birmingham or Manchester, that essentially said, parents, get your children out of the city into these. So when the edict came down, every child carried the same thing, a knapsack with, you know, a list of the exact same things in every knapsack, a luggage tag around their neck that had their name and what class they were in, a gas mask, a ration card, and a postcard to give to the parents, to send to their parents when they arrived where they were going, because most of the time they didn't know where they were going. And it all went down once the edict came down over 4 days, like you said, Chrissy. 800,000 children in 4 days. 100,000 teachers were involved. Because parents didn't go with them, the teachers went with them. And so these children would board these trains and be sent to whereabouts unknown. They would get to the town center. So for my two little girls, they end up in Oxford. And every little town or hamlet they came to, they would go to the town center or the church, and they would sit on benches. And the families who had been pre-selected and told how many children they must billet, which is what it's called, would come in and walk around and say, I choose you. I choose you. And if there were leftover children at the end of the day, they would go door to door with those children. So it's just so heartbreaking to think about what this meant in those days and what it meant for parents to send them away and what it meant for the children. And I think almost everybody in the UK would now agree that it was not a good idea. For example, when they left London, the Blitz didn't happen in London for a whole nother year. So those children were living away from their parents. And a lot of parents after months said, well, there's no Blitz. And they went back and got their children. So it's just that it was, some children had great experiences and some children had horrible experiences. So there was just a wide range. And I gave my children a good family, but I also showed how some of the children did not get very good families.
You know, it made me think about the level of trust that people must have had in their government at the time and how, Yes. You know, in today's day and age, I'm not sure that we have that same level of trust that we would ever permit No. Something like this to happen.
No, I don't think to imagine an entire country, even one as small as England, putting all their children on trains and buses to live with strangers I just think the world now is too untrusting. And you have to remember, Churchill was a great orator. He had that country, like, we are going to do everything we can to win. And they were doing everything they could. And so parents believed they were doing the right thing. And on the whole, they were. But there were some children who their big city was never bombed, but the small town where they were sent was, and they were killed. So it was meant to be a role of certainty and safety, and ended up not being exactly that.
Yeah. And what a fascinating backdrop for the story that you're telling, yeah. Because we have these external factors of fear and then these internal ones. And yes. it was just beautifully woven together. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
I just can't help but ask, piggybacking on Kristen, do we know more about human nature and the mind in the heart than we did even that short while ago? Because that was a method of survival. But now yeah. we know so much deeper that survival is more than just place. It yeah. is love, belonging, caring,
community.
Family is everything. Have we changed as a people from even...
Oh, that's interesting. I think psychology has come so far. I mean, a lot of the, this is such an interesting question. A lot of the work I read by first person accounts, you know, and I interviewed a child, they call themselves evacuees. So all the books are called Evacuee and Evacuee Letters. And I interviewed an evacuee, and being exiled from your family was so horrific for so many of them. Now, there were exceptions. There were children who lived in slums and were thrilled to be in the countryside, right? And maybe escape some even abusive families. But that was, you know, not very many of them. But this exile from the family is one of the things we know now psychologically. If you had a loving, close family, or even if it was just a good enough family, being exiled from them in a time of terror was horrific for many children's psyches. And then the other part was that nobody wanted to talk about it when it was over. So many of the first person accounts I read, and even the woman I interviewed, she was able to tell me every single thing that happened to her, how she and her brother were sent away, how they got separated and sent to different families after a couple months, and how her mom finally said enough is enough and came and got them and moved to the south of England. And I said, well, did you and your brother talk about your experiences when you were finally back together? And she said, never, not once. So not only do they carry these experiences, but they carry them silently. So I think we know so much more now about carrying trauma in our bodies, about being exiled from community and safety. I mean, one of the ways in the, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years ago that they would punish someone is to exile them from family and community, to banish and send them away. And that was considered punishment. And here they were sending an entire generation of children away from their families and community and schools and loved ones to keep them safe. So how do we decide what's more important, right? But, you know, handing our child over a fence to somebody like you saw maybe during the Berlin Wall or even now with Ukraine, do you go to save your child or do you stay together? And I think it's an eternal question, but to send an entire country's worth of children away, just, I think we know so much more now about exile, banishment, and trauma for sure.
And thank you for telling us about this Pied Piper movement, because we've read a lot of World War II books, but I did not know that.
Never heard of it.
Yeah. So that was wonderful.
And how crazy that they named it after and that's where the fairy tale came in for me, because the whole inspiration was Pied Piper is a terrible legend of drowned and disappeared children. Mm-hmm. So why would you name something that is supposed to save children after drowned and disappeared children? So that's where the idea started to weave its way in, and how would a fairy tale come into that? And I still don't have an answer from the British government why they would do that, but
they maybe don't even know. But it's
no,
something
whoever named it did it quickly. Exactly.
Now there was something else that struck me very strong in the story. I can't say who said it. I don't want to give a spoiler. Someone asked someone else, why are you so frightened of the answer? Now we know the answer is out there. The truth exists. whether we acknowledge it or not. In the real world and in the book, do we evade the answer and pretend it's not exist or ignore it? Do we want to be ignorant? Are we in denial? And does it come back to haunt us in the end?
Oh, you ask such good questions. I feel like I have to take like a half hour to think about that, but I do have to say that I think we are also built not just for story, but for certainty. And we are, it is why we have some of the structures in our lives that we have. And so we want certainty. And guess what? There is none. Right? We have to live with so much unknowing and so much uncertainty. And the striving for safety and certainty, I think, leads us many times to looking away from the truth. And whether you use the truth with a capital T or a little t, or if it's about something big or it's about something little, if it shakes the foundations of what we think is certain, we don't want to know about it. So I feel like the older I get, you know, I have grandkids now and I hit another decade birthday, the more I am willing to live with unknowing and uncertainty without standing there and saying, I don't, that can't be true, but maybe saying, what if it is true? What if it is? Let's look at it. And if it's going to shake some of the things that I think are non-negotiable, nothing is non-negotiable. You know, when I talk to people about writing and they're just starting to write, I say to them, you know, I know this because I wanted it when I first started writing. You think I have a secret that I'm not telling you. And the secret is there is no secret. And I think it's the same thing with truth, right? Like the secret is there is no secret, but you have to be willing to look at the truth and to face it, even if it starts to shake some of your certainty.
Mm-hmm. That's wisely said.
So, Patty, I want to ask you about another underlying interesting theme in your story. And that is this idea of memory and knowing things about yourself, you know, really about the core of who you are. And Hazel notes that lies and time can try to rob you of that understanding, but never entirely. Right. And she says, you know, there's that deep down knowledge about the core of who we are. And I wanted to ask you, you know, was that belief central to Camelia, her mom, and Hazel's ability to maintain hope? Why was that so important, that core of who you are knowledge?
Oh, wow. Gosh, you guys, I feel like I'm having a great psychoanalytic session, which is my favorite thing to do. I'm a pretend psychoanalyst. So there is a poet named Pedrig Otuma. He's one of my favorites. And he wrote an essay on story. And I love it because he said, some people say there are seven plots in the world and that they're told over and over and over. You've probably read that. Some people say there are three plots in the world and that we tell them over, starting with Aristotle, and we tell them over and over and over. He said there's only one plot in the world and that that plot is a question. And the question is, who am I? And that that's what every story, song, and poem is about. And I love that. And that was, without giving spoilers, part of the overarching theme of this novel, which is this search for who am I while looking in the wrong places, right? And so I am a big believer in the kind of, not kind of, the false self versus the true self, the ego versus the, what some might call the immortal diamond, the true self, whatever you want to call it, right? The thing in us that is essential, that is who we were made to be, our divine blueprint, right? And I think that most of our life should be and can be about not creating it, but discovering it and trying to listen to it through wisdom, of course, not just being like, I want this, so it's who I am. But more like an essential divine blueprint. And I think a lot of my characters are always in search of that, and I want them to be in search of that. How did trauma or lies or dogma or abuse or society keep you from understanding who you really are? And so for one character in the book, it is literal. And for the others, it is more existential.
Yeah, I thought that was fascinating because it did cause you as the reader to think about that. You know, yes. What are those obstacles in my life that are distracting me or lying to me or preventing me? Because I think you're right. Deep down, we do have a little innate sense of something isn't right when it's not right.
Yes. So. And I think, you know, we have to listen to, you know, I call it intuition. We can call it whatever we want. The Holy Spirit's proddings, intuition. But it comes to us in hints, dreams. Yeah. It comes to us in something somebody says, and we can either ignore it or look at it. And I'm always having my characters try to decide which to do.
Dad, one more quote that falls in with this.
Okay.
Because I have said this to two people this week.
Oh, wow.
Okay. One of your characters said, if you aren't living your life, whose life are you living?
Oh, I know. Isn't it so...
And I said,
it's like you should put that on our bulletin boards. I know. I know.
It kind of falls in line with our, are you being truthful to yourself?
Yeah.
This is a deep question that we all fall into this trap.
Yep. And I think it's a lifelong question. I think, like Rumi says, you live into the question. You just keep living into it over and over and over.
Yeah, it's so important. Chris and I kicked off a little discussion then about what are the things preventing you from living that authentic life? And there's just so many things, especially in today's day and age.
It also depends on your personality, right? Like some people are people pleasers, looking at Patty. Some people are more ego-based. Some people are more. So the answer isn't the same for every person about what's keeping us from living that way, right? You have to know what it is for you. So.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, Patty, we have loved talking to you about this beautiful book, and I'm so excited it's out in paperback. And I was wondering if you could just give us a little clue about what's on your radar, what's coming up next for you.
Absolutely. First, I want to say thank you so much for having me. What thoughtful and beautiful questions you both ask. I really appreciate it. I can tell you loved Flora Lee, and that means a lot to me. What's coming up next for me is a book that comes out exactly this time next year. It right now, you know, it can change. Right now it is called The Story She Left Behind. And it is, okay, I liked your nods. That was nice for those of you who can't see us. They gave us like an enthusiastic nod. It is about, gosh, I haven't learned how to talk about it yet, but it is about a woman who goes in search of a mother who abandoned her when she was 8 years old. And this mother left behind a sequel to her iconic novel, but the sequel is written in a coded language that they can't translate.
Wow.
Wow.
Well, first of all, I love that it picks up on that theme of story and how it plays such a central role in our lives in figuring out who we are, just like you've talked about. So we hope that you come back and talk to us about that. That
absolutely
book. It's fascinating. Well, wonderful. Well, thank you, Patty. And of course, we want to tell our listeners, we loved it. Go out and get this book. Listen to her weekly podcast. We just adore you. Thank you so much for your time and coming here today.
I feel like I found two new heart friends. Thank you for having me. Good to meet you both.
Yeah, she's amazing. Patty Callahan Henry, we've been wanting her to have her on here. And, you know, I am so honored because she is a huge podcaster. And for her to tell us, I like the questions, you girls are really deep. Oh, goodness, because we really, that is our niche, trying to be deep, really reading the book carefully and being deep thinkers. And Kristen, I just had to go back to your question because I loved your question about Operation Pied Piper. Whoa, what did that mean back then? And I agree with both of you, ladies. I don't see this ever happening today, ever. Are we learning from past historical mistakes? I hope so. Sometimes I feel like we're not. Maybe we are.
Yeah. I mean, you know, as I was reading that, I was thinking about desperation and the lengths to which you will go to protect your children, to protect your loved ones. And, you know, we do see people get to the state of desperation even today, where we have communities that are being, you know, driven out by war or by famine. And my heart always drops when I see that on the news of somebody handing over their baby, you know, to preserve their life, even if it's at the cost of my own. And so think about that extent of love and desperation. That to me is the only two things I could see there.
Oh, hugely. And what about, we sort of brought this up today, where children are placed in different places. with family members or orphanage or the foster system. And thank God for those loving, kind people. But there are also people that are using those children to collect the monetary benefit or as workers in their home. There's something I love when people write a book about a child, because I think you can tell truth through the eyes of a child more so than you can do it through an adult. Do you agree?
Oh, I think that's so true. Think about that. Children aren't jaded by politics or a narrative or an identity crisis. They report what they see and what they feel. And I think that's a really good observation. I like that.
And I have to ask you one more thing. Okay, let me ask you this, because you know I always have to talk about love for some crazy thing. It's my thing. You're the environment and all, and I'm like love. So this is how we're a good team. So Hazel's mother said, "I know that's hard for you to understand, but there is room in me for more love without taking love away from the people I love." Whoa. Like yes. Either you're talking to your kids or someone about a new spouse, another child, or a new friend, or someone in your life that you newly love, and the other people in your life are feeling resentful, jealous. This is some real words of wisdom here. Who says there's not enough room for one more?
I know, but you know, I have to be honest, I worried about that when I was having my second child. I was like, can I love this child as much as I loved the first? But the heart can expand to me infinitely. And I think that's a joyous thing, but that's something you have to discover. What do you
On your own. Do you think? No, I'm not sure what to think. I do believe you can love as many people as you want, but if you're the one on the side watching, yeah, you also a little bit have to learn how to love this new person in order to accept them. This is a tricky thing that we all deal with in the real world.
Yeah, absolutely.
I wondered what you thought about that. Wait, I would ask you one thing. What do you think about this? If you aren't living your life, whose life are you living? Did that hit you?
It did. And I'm so glad that you read that quote, because, you know, that's almost like a little check in your spirit where you have to say to yourself, do I resemble that remark, as my dad used to say? That is very thought-provoking. Have you asked yourself that at any time?
Ever since I read this quote, yes, I seem like I'm asking it every day. Plus, I'm asking other people. People are calling me and I'm saying, now listen, everyone. And it's just, this is what I love about fiction. There's so much real life truth and there's lessons for us to learn. And that's why I got to say, you got to pick up this book by Patty Callahan Henry. And Kristen's going to close this out, but I've got to also add, you can connect with Patty Callahan Henry on Facebook, Instagram, X, Pinterest, or her podcast. You don't want to miss her in any of those places.
Absolutely. In fact, she's got two good websites, friendsinfiction.com and Patty Callahan Henry with two L's.com. And also a newsletter, which I thought was pretty cool. She's very actively engaged with her listeners, which is beautiful. And I would like to talk a little bit about who we have coming up, because we have a tremendous lineup coming up of authors. Just a couple of them: Dervla McTiernan, Scott Carson, who you might remember has been on our show as Michael Carita, Kate White, Lisa Wingate, B.A. Paris, Hank Philippi Ryan, Ramona Ausubel, Jill Shelvis, Lisa Barr, Jeffrey Deaver, and Isabella Maldonado. We cannot wait to talk to these authors and bring them to you. We want you to also connect with us. You can find us on Facebook, on Instagram, on X, on TikTok. We've got videos on YouTube. And until next time, listeners, one of the best ways to brave the storm is to dive down deep into life-changing fiction. Thank you.